Welcome, allies, to the Visionary Activist Show, and I'm your weaver of context, Caroline Casey. So first, a little brief weaving of context. Saturn is stationing. It represents our authority that we want to insource. It's the part of us all that we must tend to outsource to incompetent sociopathic leaders or anything that makes us cringe. It's stationing now exactly opposite the moon. It's particularly humming Leonard Peltier's chart. We will come to that because it's all one story. So Saturn says for all of us, right up against it, you know, micro and macro, first dread, despair, depression, then cooked into deeper dedication and negotiation. Bodhisattva Coyote says, participatory animism is the only infinite game in town. So here we are, dissolving the hubris of humans into nutrient for participatory animism, may it be so, to dispel bad ideas disguised as energy transition. We perfectly welcome longtime ally, marine acoustician Michael Stalker, whom I think of as though the ocean adopted a human guise to be its voice. What is the ocean saying to us now? His website is ocr.org. He's done innumerable things. The full resume is posted on KPFA and at coyotenetworknews.com, where we have many, many, many participatory things brewing. Brewing, yes, full moon, council, trickster training council, visionary activist, principal council. For more information, go to coyotenetworknews.com. So welcome, Michael.
I am honored to be here, Caroline. It's really a delight. Thank you so much.
I'm delighted. And just, you know, just to dance around a little bit, in the chart of now, where Jupiter's image is a radical magazine circulating liberating ideas, you know, and about transmitting things. And then the moon in Virgo, it's right on top of Leonard Peltier's sun, opposite Saturn exactly. But the moon forms what's called a Thor's hammer. My friend Sylvia Hanley taught me this. It's a particular pattern. And at first I always say, you know, couldn't we find a jollier name for it? But if we search, Thor's hammer is the capacity to swoosh corruption out of the halls of governance. So I'm handing you and all of our listeners, Michael Stalker, Thor's hammer. Would you like to swoosh corruption out of the halls of governance?
Yeah, that sounds like a great idea. And it sounds like swinging is part of it too, right?
Swinging the hammer. And I know we're going to dance all over the place, but I am just drawn, you know, our council, our Beltane to Solstice council that's just finishing, you know, we've been really dedicated to Leonard Peltier, as many of us are. And right now, this exact moment is very, very him. The moon is exactly on Leonard's sun. Saturn's exactly opposite it. Jupiter is trining his Neptune. So just for us to see, I like the decision on his parole takes 21 days, which takes us to July 1st. That's when Steve Bannon goes to prison. And I just like the do-si-do. Leonard emerging, Steve going in. It's a prisoner exchange, right?
Sounds perfectly symmetrical.
Right. Well, that's part of the negotiating, you know, kind of wheel and deal. And, you know, I thought of you. I often think of you whenever there's anything nefarious or beautiful. But I had heard, and I recommend to many people if you can find it, you know, John Oliver's Last Week Tonight, which on Sunday was this terrifying, sad story on deep sea mining, and the nodules that these companies that say, we're here to save the world, it's a solution to the climate crisis, they want to harvest these nodules at the bottom of the deep sea for nickel and metals for lithium, you know, for batteries for electric cars. And Oliver shows us the fantastic life that is way down there, just so trippy and fluorescent, and we haven't even identified a fraction of who's there. And he does show this hoovering of these nodules, and it will destroy everything. And then he says, we don't even need to do that because now we can make you know, batteries out of salt. Anyway, I thought immediately to turn to you that we have intimacy about this nefariousness disguised as green, and there's so many things we want to put on our work altar that are doing such a thing. So,
yeah, it is really unfortunate that this is all being driven under the rubric of more. And of course, growing economies is supposed to be a success metric of capitalism, but the only thing that grows continuously in nature is cancer. So I think we need to reset our sales on this particular thing. I had been doing a lot of work with some of our colleagues at NRDC and NWF and Earth Justice and whatever on offshore wind development. And as I dug more and more into it, I realized that we're not going to get anywhere until we start talking about using less energy. We can't just unplug the pipeline and plug in the power cable and head towards the same cliff. It's just not going to work. And that is one of the artifacts in this, the deep sea mining. But there are many more. And it's really resource extraction. We are transforming offshore habitats that have been open ocean since the beginning of biological time into factories for wind development. And there's a lot of impacts on that that are not being considered. So, and I had, you know, expressed this that we were working on collaboratively on a lot of doing analysis and critiques on offshore wind development in terms of construction operation plans and siting and surveying and what have you. And I finally started saying to these people, I can't sign on to any of these documents we're generating unless we, you know, start talking about using less energy. And I was surprised the kind of, I guess, kickback I got, because, you know, NRDC, they do a lot of good things, but they're, you know, $450 million operation, and they don't, they didn't get there by doing bake sales. So it turns out that these guys are working in cahoots with an organization called Renewable Energy Wildlife Institute, REWI.org. And, you know, all the big players are there, you know, Sierra Club and Ducks Unlimited, but also BP and Shell and ExxonMobil. So these guys are in the hot tub with the people who are doing all this offshore wind development stuff. And it's a little frightening.
Yeah, no. That, well, this is yes, all hands on deck and all deeper dedication. And what can we do, you know, with positive Saturn to bind and protect? And, you know, just touching back on the story, the John Oliver story on the deep sea, bad, sad, irreverent, mean, cruel, deep sea mining. You know, the Barren Company. Says this is the solution to the climate crisis. Exploratory licenses, no license application has been rejected, right? And then the ISA, the International Sea Agreement, you know, which it's like you know, and again, slow everything down, patience, precautionary principle. There's that, which I just feel so fervently, that we do want to be informed, and then how can we participate on every kind of level. And then just in the, you know, conniption fit inducing thing, there's also, you know, a story coming out on the cutting down starting now of Joshua trees that are 80 years old for a solar farm. In Arizona, it's like, so there's that, and then in Arizona, the story that the huge swaths of land have been bought by Saudi Arabia to grow hay to be exported to Saudi Arabia for their cattle industry, and they're sucking up all the water aquifer, right? And it's like, you know, oh, citizens of Arizona, slowly coming alive. Do you know that your water is all going away to grow hay for export to Saudi Arabia? Do you know such a thing? I think that's part of it, the conniption fits, and then the cutting down of the Joshua trees for solar, you know. And I've seen you out there, that what you mentioned, that you're getting, whatever we want to call it, you know, kickback, pushback, you know, whatever the thing is, going, shouldn't we all be using less? No, that would be difficult. And it's like, well, we got to look at Saturn, which is limits, right? There's only so much water on this planet. There's a natural limit to the thing. Yes, and then, you know, I had turned to you when there was a whole polarity, you know, on Twitter about, you know, wind towers, you know, in the sea will harm whales. No, they won't. Yes, they will. No, they won't. And you come in going, it's complex, right? We love you as
it's
a voice.
It's very complex.
Let's go for complexity. Come on, humans. Complexity, responsibility.
Well, you know, one of the challenges we have is where the regulatory agencies who are supposed to be, well, Bureau of Ocean Energy Management is one thing, but National Marine Fisheries Service is under the Department of Commerce, and that's why they get development permits all the time. They basically encourage the development of the economy. But in terms of where we're looking, I'm just getting ready to resubmit a paper looking at the infrasonic sounds that are produced by these giant turbine blades. And they're not measured because it's complicated. You can't just put a microphone out there and see how loud it is. You have to sample over, you know, 30 seconds or a minute and determine how much energy is being essentially oscillated at, you know, 0.5 and 0.225 hertz. And why is this important? Well, birds need to know what the weather is. They need to get up in front of storm fronts to get tailwinds, but they also don't want to get up too early when it's unstable because they get buffeted by the winds. So birds can sense barometric pressure changes, and it's very important for them. And so now we're going to put 3,000 turbines under what's called the Atlantic Flyway. And these birds, which use it, 30% of the birds that migrate between South America and up here, use that flyway. And we're going to be putting this noise in that flyway, which will mask or obscure the barometric pressure sensors that these animals use. So I find that problematic. And I was on a call about this, maybe in November or something like that, with a bunch of ornithologists. And I mentioned that, you could literally hear these guys gasp. It's like, oh, my gosh, you know, this is a problem. And that's just above the water. Because of the long wavelengths of this fairly substantial energy, it permeates the air-water boundary quite easily. And while we don't have any direct empirical data from the whales that they use infrasonic sounds, it makes sense that they might. And Chris Clark and Bill Ellison wrote a paper a number of years ago looking at how whales migrated. For example, the humpback whales that migrate between the Gulf of Alaska and down to Hawaii on an annual basis, they don't just beeline it. They're not using straight lines that might be provided by magnetic sensing or stellar observation. They go to geological features in the ocean. They'll go over to this seamount over here and down this ridgeline. And so informed speculation that they put out is something you can't really prove, so there's no scientific papers on this, but there's presentations on it. And they basically speculated that these animals are using low-frequency energy either in their own vocalizations as a form of long wavelength echolocation, or alternately just listening to the way that the ocean currents play around these geological features, and use that as navigation cues. So now, again, we're putting 3,000 turbines along the Atlantic seaboard where the North Atlantic right whale is plying the coast, and what's going to happen? We don't know until we know. And that's a problem because these guys who I was working with on the construction operation plan critiques and things like that, we're talking about adaptive management. Well, adaptive management means when you see something happening that you don't like, you adapt. But when you have, you know, 30,000 people with jobs and you have these giant pieces of equipment, and all of a sudden you realize that the whales are disappearing or that the birds are getting lost, you're not going to stop. It's just going to be too late at that point. And that's kind of a frightening prospect.
Yes.
So we need to talk about using laughs. It's really the story.
Right. So we're spiraling this out now in the wavelength, and you're speaking on behalf of the birds and the whales in the ocean, going that think about complexity, and it is one of your great gifts, even in your bio, to take complex things and translate into accessible vernacular. That's one of your many, many gifts. Being a voice on behalf of, and so, you know, so how should we navigate this? There's many on many, many levels, you know. And I like the negotiation backstage that we can do, but what's the negotiation on stage? And then just to clarify, I found the exact notes too, which is that yesterday, you know, in Arizona, they started to cut down 4,000 Joshua trees. 4,000.
Oh, no.
They're 80 years.
Oh, no.
They're 80 years old for a solar farm, and the Joshua tree advocate who lives there and loves it says there are just as many loopholes as protections. And it's like, yeah, and they're touting it as like, look, see, solar. That's great. We're cutting down 4,000, you know. So some guidelines, some principles, some things that we want to put on the work table, some negotiating things. And yeah, as you say, you know what? Well, first, dread, despair, and depression, you know, is a rational reaction, right? But not enough. Going whoozida, and then our deeper dedication that you really embody. And are you sort of on your literal and telepathic information, Michael Stocker information tour? Like, did you know about this? Did you know about that? Is that, or?
I think when I get this paper published, finally, it's going to kind of wake some people up. But we also have to change the discussion. And that's why I was disappointed with, you know, NRDC and these, you know, big organizations, because they do have enough oomph to change the story. But if you look at, you know, the last 8 years, China has developed 27,000 miles of high-speed rail. In the last 8 years, we almost have 110 miles or so of high-speed rail that's supposed to be between San Francisco and Los Angeles downtown. Right now, it looks like the terminus points are Bakersfield and Modesto. And I don't want to insult anybody who might be from either of those places, but from an ER standpoint, the oil guys can say, well, you know, you spent 8 years building a train track from nowhere to nowhere.
Right.
And it's and, you know, there's enough money to be made in high-speed rail. It's just people want their individual cars. We have to talk about getting into a localization economies. Public transit is really frowned upon, but I think it's a deliberate. I was in Washington, D.C. a couple months ago, and I wanted to take a train from D.C. to Pittsburgh. I think it's a 5.5-hour drive, and I wanted to see how the trains worked. And it's a long story, which doesn't really bear repeating right here, except for the fact that it took me 36 hours to get to Pittsburgh. It was just a total disaster. So
that's like a blues song, 36 hours to Pittsburgh, right? it's right. So yes, well, change the discussion, change the story, and then let me just bring in, you know, the mythic atmosphere in which we all are. So the Kogi of Colombia, right? They say that we are elder brother, you are younger brother. I go, where's the women? But we'll never mind that for the moment. But they did put out their winter solstice, going, you know, what we know, that the Earth's on fire, we're heading into it, disaster. And then they said, you know, oh humans, each one of you, each person, everybody listening here in our participatory listening audience, has until the summer solstice of 2024, that's in about a week, to make their pledge to make their pledge, their Saturn, their dedication to working on behalf of the Earth. And according to now, they said, will determine if more than a third of the Earth is alive and vital by a year and a half later, the winter solstice of 2025. I'm like, okay, sounds reasonable. But let me look at the astrology, not that they use that. You know, is there, what's relating? Well, part of the...
Yeah.
The power of now is Neptune, dreams, vision, imagination, the ocean. Again, you know, for as long as we have history, human imagination has been tied to the ocean. You know, and it says, you know, what culture would pollute the ocean? A culture that's lost its mythic imagination, and only the healing of mythic imagination will heal the ocean, and vice versa. But so Neptune is at 29 degrees of Pisces, stationing now, the last degree of the zodiac. And it's as though it sort of says everything that, you know, related to the ocean and poetry and music, because you're a full Neptune guy, ocean music, and the music in the ocean. You know, anything that has ever moved humans to reverent participatory goodness is available for a fresh expression. And I go, okay, well, this is a powerful solstice time. I mean, no matter what, it doesn't require believing anything. It's like, it's a good time for everybody to make their dedication. Like, what is our fundamental dedication? And then they said, this will determine the outcome for the Earth a year and a half later at the winter solstice of 2025. And I go, well, let me look at that. So Neptune stations at 29 Pisces, backs off, and then we'll be back at the last degree of the zodiac on the winter solstice of 2025. And it's like, okay, all right, you know, we can work with that. It doesn't require belief. It requires humming, going, it's a powerful time now for everybody, just even internally, to say, what am I most dedicated to? And I kind of want to bring in everything. I want to bring in Leonard Peltier. And I still, who was your wonderful Native American mentor, ally, guide, who Yes, and he gave me an eagle feather that keeps my car running. So can you say his name again, just to bring him in to play?
Fred Wapipa. Yeah. He was the founding elder of Seven Circles Foundation, which is kind of still can be found on the internet here. He's passed on in September of 21. He passed on to the spirit world, but at 93 years old, I think that was a long run.
Well, I also just, in the spirit of Thunderheart, you know, I just want to, you know, maybe you would invite Fred in. I want to invite the friend of all life and a great buddy of mine, Vine Deloria. These are all ancestors. Bob Goff, who was the lawyer for the Lakota Sioux. Just again, these are people operating in multiple worlds of competence, imaginative and then incarnate actual, you know, just on behalf of the vision of Leonard Peltier, necessary miracle emerging. And I just thought, since everything's part of our deeper dedication and negotiating, and Stella Coyote taught me this, that it's all wheel and deal, you know, it's like, if we want this, you know, the backstage Bodhisattva Coyote goes, well, what are you humans putting on the table? If this, then this, you know, as we approach kind of backstage going, oh, forces of nature, we have been very rude, rogue species. You know, can we make some of what's coming at us metaphoric rather than literal? You know, it's you know, Edgar Cayce, great actual psychic, you know, he predicted there would be a great tidal wave in the East Coast in 1970, and what we got was Watergate. Can we make some of this metaphoric rather than literal? And backstage, according to Stella Coyote, would say, well, what are you putting on the table? What are each one of us, what is our dedication? And I'm just feeling to experiment and wheel and deal, like on behalf of the Leonard Peltier part of all of us, as Saturn is exactly opposing his sun, and it's humming right now. Hi, Leonard. What are we putting on the table? And it really is just a question The question attracts the answer, and the inner dedication magnetizes outward opportunity as just something we're putting on the table as something to entertain. There you go. So with Fred, you know, would do you want to just be a voice? Would Fred come in as an advocate for Leonard's emergence?
Oh, I'm sure he would. I'm sure he would. I mean, that whole thing is, for those who haven't been following it for the past 40 years, it's a tragedy of grand proportion, where you have a man who's been in prison because the FBI needed a fall person. And even, I think, maybe 10 years after he was incarcerated, somebody came up and said, actually, Leonard didn't do it. I did it. And they still, Leonard is a force to behold, and they wanted to have him behind bars because he was such a good organizer. He was somebody who was so attracted, his spirit was so clean that people naturally were attracted to him. And the Native Americans, you know, that we basically, I should say, the European culture has kept in turmoil ever since we arrived here. They don't want that kind of organization. They don't want that kind of clarity. And it's a sad tale. So, yes, I think Fred would definitely stand up for and put in a lot of prayers to essentially liberate this guy in his, you know, in the September of his years.
Yes. And then maybe just as a humming to all of us, you know, if Backstage goes negotiating on behalf of Leonard, on behalf of the world, behalf of oceans, behalf of everything, what are you putting on the table? And what you just articulated, it's like, well, maybe our deeper dedication to what you just said, to organizational clarity, you know, and yeah. Right now it says, don't worry about how, just really focus on what. You know, Backstage will open up avenues of possibility that weren't apparent at first. It's why we start with the desirable vision. If we start with realism, everybody goes to war. If we start with the desirable vision that everyone would like, then avenues of possibility kind of open up before that. It's a working principle.
Really something came up really beautiful this last Mother's Day. I think it was Heather Cox Richardson wrote a piece on it. But she, it was her effect. The original Mother's Day was not apostrophe S, it was S apostrophe. And it was a product of after the Civil War, where 30% of the male population in the United States had killed each other. The mothers, there one mother particularly said, you know, if mothers were negotiating this thing, it would not have happened because they had lost their sons, their grandsons, their partners, their uncles. They had lost so much on this conceit about slavery. And so they said, you know, women need to be pulled into this discussion. We can't have you guys willy-nilly shooting at each other. The thing that's a sad irony about it is that we got the 14th Amendment after the Civil War, which gave African-American men a vote. We didn't get the 19th Amendment, which basically was a equal rights based on gender, and for 40 years after that. So I think we still have this culturally, our Western culture has this fear of the power of the mother. And that is one of the things I think we need to start polishing up and bringing out a lot more, because we're making a mess of things otherwise.
No, that's great. That's great. You know, and part of what we're going to do right now in this time, this micro time, and here our time of dedication and this show with wonderful Michael Stocker. And again, you can find out more at his great website, OCR.org, full of, we're going to play some ocean sounds on the other side of this break. But for this break, we have a sexto sentido, a canto a legua. Right, so elegua, elegba, really mercury. And this chant, this song, this resonance calls our dispersed and distracted mind from the far reaches into dedicated coherence. So just to feel that. And this transition, you know, from spring to summer solstice is where Legba hands the baton to Big Mama, to the moon. to Big Mama. And just as you say, you know, my one collaborator, Sean Patrick O'Donohue, says that the war in Chechnya began to end when the Russian women marched into Chechnya to take back their sons and their husbands and go, you will not, you will not. So we want to see necessary miracles. Again, the mother's going, no, you know, not. But so here is our break music, feel it. It's the Canto Alegba that our minds are coming into coherence, and we'll be back on the other side with more Michael Stalker and voices from the ocean, the belugas and the minke whales and the bearded seals. So here we go, Alegba.
Bara alo yure so ke woda omonia la wana mama kenya ira wo e bara su ayo omonia la wana mama kenya ira wo e o bara su ayo eke
Canto a Alegba from Sexto Sentido. This is the Visionary Activist Show. I'm your weaver of context, Caroline Casey. Our guest this hour is Michael Stalker, who is dedicated to the ocean and music. The ocean and music. It's all one thing that you're doing, lad. And how do you connect the ocean and music? Well, they are connected, but they are embodied in you, right?
Yeah, definitely. It's I call myself a marine bioacoustician. Mm-hmm. And so that basically is to try to understand how animals use the marine habitat in an acoustical way. And it's really, again, very nuanced and very complex. Sunlight doesn't penetrate too deep into the ocean. In fact, get down a few hundred feet, it's always dark down there. And so in exchange for that, the animals developed a very amazing set of ways of using sound, because you can make a sound in the ocean you can hear 2,000 miles away, because it transmits sound very well. So pretty much every animal in the ocean does something interesting with that. And some of the sounds that we hear, I'm not sure if you have the belugas queued up.
We have everybody. We have the minkies, the belugas, the bearded seals, and the mantis shrimp all lined up for you to call upon whenever you wish. But yeah, the voices, voices.
Let's try belugas. The belugas are one of the most acoustically complex animals on the planet.
Okay.
Twenty of them. They're talking and hunting at the same time. There's about 20, 25 of them, and they're doing two complex things simultaneously. And this is a sound.
Okay. Oh, great backstage ally board up. Let's bring up the belugas. That's great. And what are they saying, Michael Stocker?
Well, I mean, they're hunting cooperatively, and that goes on forever. That just happens to be like a 10-second slice, but they
right.
just that's how they live in that habitat. And they can both echolocate, and there seems to be evidence that these animals can project those echolocating, if you will, phonic images to each other. So they eavesdrop on each other. So they're living in two spaces. The squeals and all that kind of musical stuff are social sounds. That's they're kind of talking to each other, using names and things like that. And then they have this other realm where they're, you know, it's kind of like us walking through a museum with all this visual stuff around us and having a conversation. It's the same similar types of thing. But there's a bunch of them having it at the same time. So they're inhabiting this space that they're constructing acoustically.
Right, and that's the story that came out, I guess, this week to our dim-witted species, that whales know names. Right, that they can go hello and hello Frank or whatever but that whales have names and they can address each other by name.
Right, and the way they use it, they've known that dolphins have names for each other or for themselves, and the way they typically use it is that when I'm swimming along and I'm coming up next to Barbara, I go, Mike's coming up on your left. And Barbara knows that. But when they use each other's names, and this is where they found out that the names were intercommunicable or transferable, is in captive dolphin situations when they are doing, you know, inspections or some medical treatment or something like that, Barbara will be up on the deck and she'll be calling my name, like, hey, Mike, you know, help me out here. And, so they actually use names transferably like that. And that was found a number of years ago. But now that they're starting to see other, I mean, it's not a big surprise. These animals know how to identify each other. And but they're just us brilliant human beings. There was somebody sent me some stuff a while back thinking that we could use AI to translate what sperm whales were saying to each other, because they're also a very yakative organism. And, you know, my response to that is, if we could understand what they're saying, we wouldn't know what they're talking about. You know, it's kind of the Wittgenstein thing. We can't imagine the world that they live in. I mean, we're actually quite crude. You know, we actually go out and beat each other up for no reason. And these animals don't do that. They cooperate. Or if, you know, like the orcas are, both mutually predacious, they have their own dialects and they stay away from people who are not part of their game. But they don't go beat each other up.
For no reason. I mean,
they do.
Right, or for stupid reasons. Yeah. That's right. I know. So we're really here to call on the ceasefire on behalf on the part of our species on all of life. I mean, on all of life. It's like we want to drill the deep ocean, even though we don't really need to, because we can. We want to drill in the Arctic, not because there's really that much oil preserved, just because there's some perverse demon possession to just, you know, kill and destroy, you know, whether it's Gaza or the ocean or the thing. And then language. I just remember also this dolphins imprisoned, hostage dolphins everywhere, you know, but in England, and they found that when the dolphins were sleeping, they began to speak whale. And I was like, oh. And I heard that story, and I lived with Stella Coyote, actual coyote, and wonderful Moondog, part wolf, had died, and she was grieving. But after hearing that story, in the middle of the night, Stella howled wolf, right? I mean, she'd never done that before.
Oh, wow.
It's very different from a coyote. You know, it's like, Stella, you've never howled wolf. You've never spoken wolf language before. So these are mysteries. I mean, language, and rather than our galumphy, like, oh, let's just mine it and blow it up. And then it's like curiosity and complexity, and maybe microdosing will help, you know, just to guide us into these realms of where we approach the world with curiosity and wonder. And what's your story? And I do think of yourself and as an inspiration for all of us, you know, to dedicate on behalf of what we love in nature to be its cultural agent. And that's, I mean, isn't that a fair what you do? Part of the many things that you do, aren't you that?
I would say that's my intrigue, definitely. It's something that I, you know, when I think about going down and mining nodules down at the bottom of the sea, there's not a lot of sunlight down there, and as a consequence, there's not a lot of energy to harvest down there. So the animals that you see may be small, but they also are probably really, really old. Because they grow slowly. And so we're basically going down there and proposing to basically slaughter our elders so that we
right,
can make some
again.
Money off of their habitat.
Right.
Yeah.
Yes, no, lots of little small ancient creatures. Again, we would do well to honor and, you know, honor Leonard Peltier, honor those older creatures living on, live on the nodules. And then... But then there's also, I mean, in John Oliver's, you know, film clip from the Sunday Show, amazing beings, right? I mean, just amazing, like, witty, weird creatures that are all depending on the smaller organisms that are living on the nodules that, you know, the barren corporation wants to harvest because it will save the earth by transitioning into, you know, renewable energy, you know, and batteries for electric cars that we don't need because we can make them out of salt. So more information and dedication, you know, certainly is, you know, part of our solstice aspiration. And the reason I loved playing that beautiful a cappella, you know, Legba chant, it's old, right? It's morphic resonance. It's been chanted in Cuba and syncretized from Africa, and always with the dedication and of really calling in our minds, you know, and calling in our deep selves, that we, this time of deep dedication, I think it's the only antidote to fear and depression is, you know, Saturn says, depression, too shallow, go deeper. You know, maybe if we went deeper in our own sea, we wouldn't mess with the deeper sea. You know, go deeper into the dedication. What are each one of us willing to pledge, to dedicate, to being a cultural agent on behalf of something we love by the mysterious detective novel of our lives? You know, I love coyote people. I love the wolf people. I love, you know, you love the ocean. Well, we love everything. But again, now it's, and I think that's part of the wheel and deal backstage, going, if this, then this. If you tell me your story, I will tell it for you. And then to may it penetrate deep into the heart of even the unlikeliest of beings, the capacity to open portals between worlds. And you just, if I hope you don't mind if I mention your chart, just because you have 800,000 planets in Leo, which is to make visible the invisible, to make audible the inaudible, which you do so well. And your Mercury quintiles Saturn, sharp, smart, mind, you know, opening the portal to sanity and dedication to enter into the world. Thank you very much. So who should we listen to next? We have these wonderful short clips. We've got minkies and bearded seals and mantis shrimp. Shall we go to the minkies?
The minkies are really interesting. This was recorded by... what's her name? Reich. Anyway, she's
on the recording. I'm
slipping my name, her name right now. But she's a. Essentially, what we're going to hear is these minkies pulse. They kind of thump, and you hear one initially, and then you hear this kind of too pulsing, but it slows down immediately. So they're in training to each other. And I delivered a talk on this. What I didn't have two hydrophones, unfortunately. Then you could, but through time of arrival, be able to really determine where these animals were. But the one hydrophone that it was recorded on, there's a difference in amplitude as well that matches in terms of propagation delay time to the two thumps. But what they're doing, let's just listen to it first and I can kind of get into it. You hear basically one thumping fast and then all of a sudden another one comes in and they both slow down.
Okay, that's great. So here it's just 15 seconds, but it's very rich of the minky entrainment. Here we go.
Why are they doing that? What are they doing here? If it's anything like crickets that entrain with each other, you hear them kind of yeep, yeep, yeep on a hot summer night. They essentially synchronize to each other. And how do they do that? If they're displaced by 4 feet and they're making all this noise, how are they actually listening in to somebody else to synchronize with them? What actually happens is when they make their little crick, they have a neurological blanking that blanks out that crick, so they can't hear anything when they're cricking. And so what they're doing is they're listening for other cricks, and if they're out of sync, they hear it. If they synchronize up with it, they don't hear anything. So everything's perfect for the cricket world if they're all cricking away and they're not none of them are hearing anything. Then all of a sudden, a guy like me comes along and encroaches on this large auditory landscape that they make. And one of them slows down a little bit, all of them says, something's going on over there. So they have a community ear. They know what's happening by the kind of the morphic delays of their own community cricking. And so it's funny because a lot of the studies on cricket synchrony and looking at it in terms of breeding sounds have essentially female crickets surrounded by these speakers, and they try to figure out, you know, what is the breeding fitness announcement here. And it's so human oriented in terms of, you know, what's the sweeter sound or what's the more powerful sound. It's, you know, what does the community say? What does the community hear? How do these animals synchronize with each other and save, you know, essentially save the sanctity of the community itself? And that's what I think is happening with the minkies. We're working on a project right now to try to ostensibly to hear whales in shipping lanes so that we can pinpoint where they are and then use that information to prevent whale ship strikes. But once we get those hydrophones in place, we'll be able to sight in on that species of whether minkies or out here in California, they'd be either blue whales or fin whales because they all pulse. It's all that kind of that. Genus of whales, they all pulse. And so we can then determine if that, in fact, is what they're doing.
And where are the Minkies? Remind us geographically.
They're pretty much global. I don't think you'll find them any much higher than about maybe 50 degrees latitude. Actually, no, because the Antarctic, they have a lot of them down there, too. They're all over the place. And okay. It's unfortunate that they're being predated upon by the Japanese.
Saturn says bind, you know, invite in binding to accountability, sending a dream, sending Trump a dream of a giant shark beneath him saying, if you're not good, again, what's available to us. And we should mention that your book, Here Where We Are, Here, H-E-A-R, Where We Are, Sound Ecology and Sense of Place, is a wonderful book. And all these are forms of intimacy, right? To see, to hear, the more language, the more words, the more everything, the more avenues of participation, the more we know, the better, right? So there's the from years ago, Joanne Locke and her book, The Voice in the Infinite and the Small, Healing the Human-Insect Relationship, a great book. I still remember that show. It's like 20 years old, I think, but we kill what we don't know about. We kill what we don't understand, And she tracks us from children like, ooh, creepy crawly, step on it, all the way to war, right? All the way to war. The whaling war. If we just know more, oh humans, right? So we do have some other wonderful guests. The bearded seals, one of my favorite, because it's so super, what we humans think of as supernatural. It's like, I'd like to put it as a ringtone on my phone. Before we hear the bearded seals, it's very, very trippy. And where are the bearded seals, and what might they be saying, and how do you want to set it up for the bearded seals?
These are Arctic seals. They're in this kind of classification called ice seals, which have the ring seal and the bearded seal. In the Antarctic, they have the Weddells. These animals also inhabit a very dark space at certain times of the year. It's no sunlight up there, and so they've developed this amazing repertoire of sounds. This was probably recorded in April or May, which is breeding season up in the Arctic. And for those of you who are interested in Arctic sounds, we have on OCR.org a sound. Actually, I think this is to explore the Arctic. We have essentially a week of Arctic sounds during the breeding season, where we have the bowhead whales and various seals, including the ice, the bearded seal, all making these amazing sounds. So with no further ado, just do it up. Let's see what we got.
Okay, here's the bearded seals. It's about 44 seconds. Here we go. That's so great. There we have it, team. That's the bearded seals of the Arctic, brought to us by our wonderful guest and ally, Michael Stalker. So we wouldn't know unless somebody had a hydrophone down there. I mean, we wouldn't hear that. We dim-witted humans wouldn't hear that on the surface, would we?
The old sailors of yore would hear this through the hulls of their boats, and that's where we get all these scary sirens and those old pictures of dragons and sea monsters, they were hearing that stuff. And
oh, that's great.
They didn't know what it was.
Right. Well, it's so spooky, and it is not unlike Icelandic spooky magic kind of shamanic songs. And then a lot of our sounds too. That's really great. So, but over and over through the years, you know, in your dedication, you know, let's honor myriad life and be aware of it and protect it. And as we're on our way out, well, we do have mantis shrimp. We have mantis shrimp. Let's fit the mantis shrimp in. Just 26 seconds of mantis shrimp. Here we go. Oh, that's all we have. All right, never mind. I give it then to you. The mantis shrimp have disappeared. You'll have to just find us at coyotenetworknews.com or oco.org. And then these last moments, I mean, you are a great Michael Stocker de-bamboozler, right? So that when we hear about the deep, unnecessary mining and destruction of the bottom of the sea, we go, no, wait a minute. When we hear about the cutting down of 4,000 Joshua trees for a solar farm, we go, no, wait a minute. So is there a last prayer for human de-bamboozling sanity that you'd like to invoke on our way out here?
I think using less energy is where I think we need to do this thing.
That's good. That's good. We keep it simple and it's true, and then we go into, like, for instance, how we can do such things. Well, we look forward to your detailed program, your protocol guiding about here's how we do it, and it'll be fun. It will be more
Tap pleasure. Into our newsletter. You can get our newsletter through the OCR site.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah. I have a lot of essays on this type of stuff.
Right. Okay. But it's too late to play the mantis shrimp. You'll just have to go to OCR.org. I think that's right. But thank you always, Michael Stocker. We're in cahoots. We are grateful for your dedication. We aspire to be as dedicated as you are to what we love. Thanks always to Kirsten Thomas. Likewise.
Thank you so much. Yeah.
My pleasure. Many things brewing at coyotenetworknews.com, ways to participate, and we will reconvene next week, which is the actual summer solstice. Thank you, team.